Adam, this is our 100th episode, and we are literally unscripted. I have no script in front of me today.
And you forgot to send me a script, so I have no idea what we're going to talk about.
Let's see what happens.
It's showtime. This is The Ski Show, the ultimate show ski podcast, and your one and only source for all things show skiing, bringing you news, knowledge, and interviews with the legends and stars of our sport. Here are your hosts, Matt Heilman and Adam Schaller.
Welcome to the Ski Show. This is our 100th episode of the Ski 100. Show podcast, and we are unscripted. As we said, I literally, for 99 episodes, I've typed up a script. We've had sponsor ads. We've had the whole thing. We decided this time to have nothing, and it is me and Adam and David Raisin on the show, just talking show skiing. Who knows where this is going today? I've poured a bourbon. I've got an old fashioned here, and we're going to talk show skiing. So I have no idea where this is going, Adam.
Well, I think since it is the 100th episode, we should probably start with you, Matt. How did this all get started? Like, where did you come up with, because this is 100% you. You asked me to do it. Like, tell us, fill us in. Where did this idea come from?
It's a great question. So it probably started back with the Showski Mag days when I ran that and started that. And it was the online magazine, had news articles. Like, I've always wanted show skiing to have a bigger media platform. Like, that we have such a passionate niche audience that I've always wanted it to have this bigger presence because I knew people would soak it up. Our community would soak up news and information and data and statistics and conversation and all of that. And so it started with Showski Mag, and then I, you know, that flamed out, just didn't have the time to give that was hard work to give it the time it needed. And so then podcasting started to come in vogue a little more, and thought, let's do this. And then, you know, who better to have as a co-host than you? I actually talked to Dave about it. We were talking about the
I could actually think of a lot of people that would be better, but
that's, no. That's, so the example, Dave and I listened to sports talk radio, and the example we gave was the Dan Le Batard show. He's got Stu Gatz. And Dave was like, you need your Stu Gatz.
Adam,
like,
has no idea who you're talking about right
no.
now.
No. Nope. I'm assuming he's a real dummy. Like, he doesn't.
Well.
Great. I'm going to Google this afterward. I'm probably going to be pissed.
Well, Stu Gatz. So that's where it is. So then it was like, yes, it's got to be Adam Schaller. and so then I asked you, and we're in COVID. And so what better time when we're all locked down to fire it up when we've got time on our hands, right? We're all sitting at home. And so I literally started Googling, trying to figure out how to host a podcast, what equipment we need, how to do it virtually, what platform to be on. And we dove in, and we had Matt May as our first guest. And
would this have happened without COVID? Was that like the push? Like, I'm literally have nothing to do and I'm stuck at home.
That's a great question. It may not have. Yeah. I mean, because we had the time, like, and it was, there was news, there was event. I mean, we had just come home from Worlds getting canceled. So there was current events in show skiing. It was relevant. And there was a reason and a purpose.
People were thirsty for content. They were out there. There was no show skiing. So any bit of show skiing that people could talk about, converse about, past, present, future, they were looking for at that point in time.
Yeah. So here we are at 100 episodes, like, and we talked a lot about should we do something special for our 100th episode? Should we have recorded it live at Think Tank? Or we had some other dumb ideas. Yes, Bria and Kaylee, we did consider allowing you guys to have too many White Claws and interview us.
Matt considered that. I never considered that.
No, Adam was afraid. Adam was afraid. So we ended up doing nothing special for our 100th, and it's unscripted. We're just going to talk shop.
And I mean, to be honest with everybody that's listening, that makes me extremely uncomfortable because there's no one that is more structured or prepared, obviously, than the four individuals, Brad Satterley included, that are on this podcast at this point in time. To go completely unscripted without any semblance of structure, I'm breaking out in hives right now. But let's do it.
Yep.
Okay, first awkward silence. What are we going to talk about next?
Yeah, I mean, where's this podcast going, Adam? Like, have you thought about this?
Well, you know, that was a question I was, I mean, that's kind of a, it's kind of a question I was going to ask is like, where do you guys see yourselves in 10 years? And I was going to ask you that question. Like, yeah, how, I mean, we're at 100 episodes. How much, you know, how long do you continue doing this? I don't know. I guess we just, as long as people keep listening, we're going to keep pumping out podcasts, I guess. Right. And,
you know, yeah, I don't know if we'll have a sense of when people are tired of us or it or stop listening or it's not.
Well, you have stats on that. You know, when
matter. I do.
Don't
yeah,
listen
we do.
Anymore.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what I'm hopeful for, and you can see it now, the younger generation, you can see the future stars already. I mean, I could literally name a dozen young individual skiers, whether it be breaking through in swivel or freestyle jump or trick skiing or barefoot, whatever it may be, that I would be interested in hearing about, listening about, understanding what makes them tick, where, you know, what their motivation is, so on and so forth. And so, you know, Sarah Fedorowicz, Hudson Fox, mm-hmm. I mean, the Carson boys. I mean, there is this up and coming generation that I, you know, I'm excited about, and they're going to take the torch and they're going to carry it far into the future.
Yeah, somebody asked me if we're ever going to run out of topics or guests, and the answer is no.
I think I asked.
Because there's always the next generation of skiers, right? We still have legends and topics to take care of, but there's always the next generation.
Yes.
You know, speaking of that, I was thinking about this, you know, with you know, freestyle jump making a huge comeback and swivel and just the excitement that seems to be around show skiing in the last couple of years. It's my personal opinion. I think all of that started with Worlds back in 2012. I think it's hard to kind of put into words, but it's something, you know, that people were then inspired by and aspired to be. You know, so it was just this bigger thing kind of beyond just your local team and something that everybody could, you know, kind of get around, right? So it's...
And it was the ability, so I agree with you, because it was, especially from a freestyle jump and swivel standpoint, it was those competitors together, pushing each other together and seeing what each other could do, doing it together on the water, pushing each other to the next level, getting ready for the next Worlds. Like, I think the first Worlds in 2012 had a huge influence on the growth of the sport today because of people's desires to be better.
Yep.
Matt, we talked about this. When we were younger, it was, you know, hey, I want to potentially win Skip. I want to win Willa. I want to win some sort of individual accolade at either a regional or national tournament, or it was, I want to ski professionally at some point in time. And that Skip Willa thing, that still is to this day. I mean, that is the pinnacle of our sport from an individual standpoint, but you know, it's so unique, so seldom, and there's not a lot of opportunity there. But unfortunately, we've seen that with professional shows as well, the shrinking of the professional shows and how they've shut down at theme parks, nationally, internationally. And that's where I think almost at the same time, Team USA and the World Tournament stepped in. And now that is a third option, again, that a lot of individuals are now aspiring for, to try out for that team, to be in a candidate for that team, to potentially be picked for that team. And that's fun to see.
Yeah, it's huge. People want, that's a goal. It's a life goal for so many up and coming people to be a part of that team and to be on Team USA. And it's become this thing that become, it's that goal, it's that aspiration that now so many people strive for. And now that we did that larger sort of tryout after Nationals, the interest in that and just being a part of that group and having people, a larger group together as kind of a training camp, that was cool too.
Yeah. I think with that comes pressure. I feel pressure as a show director. I know that other past show directors feel pressure as well, because there's a certain expectation when you join Team USA in terms of the experience that you have. It's not just about the show. It's not just about competing. It's about the overall experience from day one, from being selected until that final show, that final Sunday show, and being part of something special. And it's not just what's on the water, right? And so trying to meet that threshold and surpass that threshold and making sure that it's an event and experience for everybody, it comes with a hefty responsibility.
And kind of, yes, I feel that pressure too, to make sure everybody's experience, if we exceed their expectations in participation on the team. We also have a global responsibility as the United States of America, having won all these world championships and setting the bar globally for what show skiing should look like and raising that bar and not having anyone overtake us. There's that pressure, right?
Yeah, pretty slim margins.
Yeah.
We can only go down from here.
Can, really. I mean, so let's while we're on Team USA, let's talk about it. We just came off of our training and spring break. What were your takeaways on that, gentlemen? And what'd you think? We had a couple of days team together in Winter Haven. What are your takeaways?
It was windy, like all the time.
Yeah,
but I mean, it was windy, but I think after being to several of these, I feel like the first couple of times it was people would kind of get together and do some skiing and, okay, let's go out and try a back barefoot line of 3-4 guys. And it was a, yard sale. But now fast forward to 2024 and it's just like clockwork and you're putting out 6-7 guys and they all make it and putting out all these different jumps, and it's just the expectation that these things are probably going to make it on the first, second try, and they do.
Is that because of the talent base? Do we think that's because of the talent base, because of the chemistry that's built with some people who have now skied together for more than one world championship together?
It's got to be. I mean, that's definitely a part of it. And, you guys having done this several times is you know how to organize a practice. And I think, a lot of the veteran skiers know going into this practice what to expect. And it's not just, the chemistry with the skiers that have had opportunity to ski together before. It's just, it's not this, you got the new guy next to you, not sure what he's going to do. They all kind of know. And so these practices to me are just like so high level and just the stuff that you can put out there, which, 6 years ago, you wouldn't even think of dreaming of doing, and you write it on the board and they go out and they nail it. It's just, it's kind of unbelievable, really. It's pretty cool.
My takeaway on this one, yes, we had wind, we had, you have challenges with weather and things, but this team is a super interesting mix of veterans and up-and-coming talent, rising stars, and it's this really unique mix. And the for the older veterans who have done it, like Team USA gives them a reason to hang on, like to do this one more time and to keep their skills sharp into their late 30s or into their 40s. Like they want to do this because they want to be a part of Team USA one more time. So you see aging veterans hanging on to their skills, which is super cool. And then you combine that veteran leadership and talent with some rising stars. And that mix was super fun to see.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, 40% turnover from 2022. So, we had plenty of veteran influence, but enough of the new kids into the mix. I think it helps. We've also learned where we've been inefficient during those practice times. So inside story for those listening, inside scoop. We back barefoot line has been kind of our Achilles heel when it comes to practice. We spent a lot of time on that, haven't always been successful. So, you know, this year we made sure that we're communicating with all the guys, making sure that they understand that they need to come in, making their flip turns. Making your flip turns by yourself behind the boat is different than making a flip turn with 8 other guys behind the boat, right? And then also what side they should be stepping off on, if they want curl, 1 out, 2 out, 3 out, wake or whatnot. And then ultimately motivating them. So any guy who misses their flip turn, they have to buy pitchers that night. So they kind of know that if you're going to waste time on the water by missing a flip turn, you're going to go ahead and you're going to pay up and you're going to pay the rest of the guys in the end. So we have a little bit of fun with it as well. But I think my point is it's that proactive communication, setting expectations in terms of where people are going to be, whether it's in a certain jump, in a 1080, 1440 line, in a certain mix or a certain jump that's being tried, that they can mentally put themselves in that place and they can come in prepared. Because to be honest with you, Matt, you know this, Brad and Adam, there's not a lot of reps. I mean, we go ahead and we send out jump one, we send out jump two, everybody gets maybe 3 or 4 reps. Nobody wants more than that because, again, bodies are a little bit sore and on winter legs. But at the same time, there's that intensity and that competitive atmosphere. Like, this is it. This is the practice. We got to make this. We got to bring this home. And so that's the fun part of it. That's the fun part for me.
Yeah. And you know, when we're in Florida, we're blessed to ski at Jackson's and have two lakes at our disposal. If we were at a ski site with one lake, we would only get half as much done as we do. So we divide and conquer, and Dave takes the lead with the guys. I take the girls. We're on separate lakes. And the girls was super interesting because they have got a lot of girls get comfortable with their speed and their place in the wake. And when it came time to a bigger line, 4 or 5 girls doing 1080s, and they wanted to try 1440s, and some of them had to ski in spots or speeds outside their comfort zone. That's super interesting to see that dynamic and the give and take. And my takeaway on that and my advice to future Team USA applicants is be as versatile as possible. Like, make sure that you are able to ski in multiple spots on the ramp, back barefoot on both sides of the wake, swivel in the dip, on the bubbles, at 13 and a half, 14 and a half, 15, like be versatile, and that'll help you succeed once we're all together. They did a phenomenal job and the chemistry was awesome. And it was super fun to see the swivel pairs and the 1080 lines, and the girls crushed it. But it's interesting to see some of them in uncomfortable positions because they've got their position in the wake and their boat speed they like to go. And there's got to be some compromise there.
Yeah, and to your point, when we're assessing those candidate videos, it's not that 900 reverse melt that's making our eyes bulge out. It's that person who goes ahead and sends in a video and shows that they can do a 720 outside of the curl, in the dip, in the dip, in right in the middle of the wake, and then make their way right onto the other side. That's like, okay, versatility. That's awesome. We can use her anywhere. So.
Yeah, the dude that flips in 4 spots on the ramp, like, you know.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's good stuff. Good Team stuff. USA. All-American I was at. I don't know if neither of you two were. Dave, no. You traveled home. Spring break was over. It was cool. Number of participants was great. Jump on Friday night. Had kind of a team jump event. Four teams. Some fun stuff there. Some great freestyle. Pete Hegarty made the first in competition ever heli rewind, and that's a one ski heli and then spin back 180 and land backwards.
So I have a question for you guys who were there. You guys obviously saw that Pete put out on social media, Instagram.
Yep.
He gave 4 different options of 3 jumps that he would be willing to do, and he said vote on it. Did he end up going with the winner?
He did. And so I talked to him about that.
That is like the first time freaking.
It was awesome.
How versatile that guy is. Unreal.
It was awesome. And I talked to him right before the jump and I said, are you going to listen to the fans? And he said, yep. So then he went and he fell on his one ski Moab And the question buzzing through the audience is he going to stick to his game plan or is he going to play to win? Because all he had to do was go do one ski front and a back half, of which he could do in his sleep, both of those and win.
Yeah.
But he stuck to his script. And so then he came back and he did his back half and then he did the heli rewind. That third jump, he already had a fall. He could have fallen and probably lost the event, but he went, goes, and he said he's only made 5 or 6 heli rewinds in his whole life. And to our knowledge, nobody's made it in competition, and he stuck it, and it was amazing.
That's cool. That's cool. He's a gamer.
Super fun. Yeah. It was great. So good stuff. That was fun. Great All-American tournament. Leslie Gunderson did a good job of organizing that. It was really well run from a leadership organizational standpoint of paperwork and music and all of it, drivers, practice times. The tournament was really well run.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Yeah.
You know, while we're on the topic of Team USA, I want to ask both of you, you know, you talk about the experience, right, and having put on a world-class show, but what is, in your opinion, each of you will probably have a different answer, what's the worst part of being a Team USA show director? Not the best part, what's the worst part?
I'll jump. Selections. Selections bring a whole level of pressure. Selections are fun, right? When the process is great because you're putting all these chess pieces together and you're outlining what you want to do from an act order and from a production standpoint. But inevitably, we are fortunate enough to have more talent than we do spots, right? And the margin in those last handful of selections is razor thin. And a lot of times doesn't come down to the overall expertise or skill set of a skier. It's, hey, this one person is really awesome, the best at this one specific skill, and that's where we need them the most. And could go into detail in regards to that, but I think that that's the most difficult. And then certainly going ahead and having those follow-up conversations, and what Matt and I take a great deal of pride in is reaching out to anybody who was on Team USA formally, who had formally got selected, making those phone calls, making those calls to people who got invited in terms of the tryout, and giving them that constructive feedback in terms of why they were not selected and where there's opportunity for a growth or improvement.
Yeah, and you guys wouldn't have to do that, but I think it's. I'm glad that you do, right? And I think most people appreciate that, and they should, right?
Otherwise, I mean,
you guys just make the selections and throw the names out on Facebook and say, "Congratulations, here's Team USA."
And why isn't that?
We could do that.
Yeah, and why isn't? I mean, part of that is there's tears, there's anger, there's frustration, and just understanding that any emotion is okay when it comes to that, and just being there to continue to explain, to try to support that. So,
So I'll piggyback on that. Like that. So the selections are tough, but phone calls to those who did not make it is really tough. Like Dave and I put a lot of care and love into the selections, into the team, a lot of pride. Our duty is to put the best team together, and we've been in this a long time. We have a lot of teammates, friendships, families who we've gotten to know over the years, and making those phone calls to people we know that maybe are teammates on our amateur team or have been on Team USA in the past and they didn't make it this time, that is really hard, and we want to man up and take responsibility for it and explain why, and be man enough to have that conversation and have respect for them. Like that's the key, is the respect. And there were some really hard conversations, as Dave said. There were tears, there was questions, and all of that is okay. Any emotion somebody has in the moment is okay, because everybody handles it differently. the fun conversations are the ones that people make it for the first time and they're bawling because it was their life goal to make Team USA and they make it. That's super cool too. And we get the benefit of doing that. And what comes with it is the challenging phone calls. And so that's super hard. You know, the other challenging parts of being a Team USA show director, the parts we don't like are the, quite frankly, the parts that Dave and I have delegated to better people. Like the logistics of travel and equipment is a nightmare. And Dan Wong is a saint. It's still like for Dave and I, it's still stressful because there's just going to Australia. There's a lot going on and a lot of figuring out and a lot of people to keep track of and a lot of, you know, we're responsible across the world for a team of 40 and there's a lot that goes with it and that's challenging. So those logistics are hard.
Same holds true. Now, you know, Brad's here from a treasury standpoint, tracking the finances, making sure we understand what's in each account, understanding what is due at what time when certain payments need to be made, when contributions need to be made, sponsored dollars are coming in, so on and so forth.
That's the worst. That's all the worst. Figuring out the budget and stressing about having enough money to make this trip. That's the worst. That's terrible. Yes. Cause and thankfully we've built processes in place over time. Like the first Worlds 2012, I was co-show directors with Chris Copeland and we're in a bar in Madison laying out our budget, handwritten, trying to figure it out. And we were CEOs of every aspect of that. There was not really a management team in 2012.
Right.
We had to fundraise. We had to do it all. We had to figure out the budget. Now, thankfully, our budget at that time was like $65,000. This year, it's nearly $300,000 with the travel across the world and the increased cost. But that was challenging for him and I the first time. There's no roadmap. And figuring it out and the stress that came with having to not just be a show director. We were club president, treasurer, fundraiser, committee lead, all the things. And that was tough. And fortunately now we've put processes in place to help with that so that the show directors don't have to shoulder everything by themselves. So it's gotten better, but it's still stressful for sure.
Yep. Sounds awesome. Sign me up.
So I've got a question shifting off Team USA a little bit. Here's a question for both Matt and Adam. Who is the one guest that you would like to have on, but you haven't been able to have on the show as of
yet? No-brainer for me. It's a no-brainer. And I've tried. I had a conversation with him again this week.
I know who you're going to say.
I want Lynn Novikovsky on the show.
You should.
I want Lynn Novikovsky, and I've asked him many times, and Lynn is not much to in terms of wanting a public persona, but Lynn has so much history to share and so much. I mean, like we've all seen his photos, but he's a Hall of Famer, an all-time great legend who's been through it all through the gardens. He started with the Minocquabats. Like his history, we would do a three-part episode with Lynn just on the freaking history of show skiing and the stuff he's been through. I want Lynn. So if anyone out there can help us convince Lynn to come on the podcast and tell his story, that to me is number one.
Yeah, I'm gonna echo that, and not necessarily. I want to do the Minocquabat episode because Minocquabats is what got my interest sparked in show skiing when I was a kid, and so learning more about the history there of that club, which I believe is the oldest amateur club in Wisconsin, I'm pretty sure it is, but yeah. So, and if Lynn fits that bill, heck yeah, we want Lynn Nowakowski on the show.
Yep. I did reach out to some people and got some contacts of some folks that have good history of the Minocquabats. So I think we've got a start there of some people to reach out to get that episode rolling for you, Adam.
I tried out for the Minocquabats. I didn't make it.
You didn't?
Just an FYI.
How old were you? Let's tell the
12.
Story. How old
I was
were
12.
You were 12. Yep. What'd you do?
So you get three, well, at the time, you got three passes to do whatever you wanted. So, of course, I kneeboarded. And that was long before I was inverting. So I think I did like surface turns. I don't know, whatever. Shoe skied and I don't know. I think I did a slalom or something. And then there was some 10-year-old kid that went right after me that bombed out of two skis and barefooted all the way around the show course and then tumble turned and landed. So I was like, F you. No chance.
Interesting.
I've heard some fantastic stories about the Minocqua bats. I was out there a couple of years ago in Hazelhurst at Pittenger's Cabin and decided to go ahead and bike on in and just wanted to sit at the Minocqua Bowl and just kind of take it all in. And, you know, ultimately the kids run the team fully.
Yep.
And
oh yeah, for sure.
There is no matter how, if I understand correctly, and I'm getting this right from, you know, the folks a couple of years ago that were on the team, no matter how good you are, you're going to pay your dues for the first year or two. And paying your dues means coming down after each show. And I think they have like four or five shows a week, basically. And cleaning the clubhouse, straightening everything up, cleaning the bathrooms, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that is part of ultimately kind of the first couple years and paying your dues on that team. I thought it was fantastic.
So Adam, that's what got you hooked in show skiing was watching the Minocqua bats, and you actually tried out.
Yep, I mean, but before I saw the Minocqua bats, so I'm pretty sure that I saw a Quahomet show.
Wow!
And I bought a T-shirt, and I was sitting in the back of my parents' minivan, and I saw in the rearview mirror the T-shirt. I'm like, oh, it's Tomahawk backwards. I get it. Wow. Otherwise, awesome. I had no idea where that name comes from.
Most people don't know that Quahomets is Tomahawk spelled backwards.
Yeah, I think they think it's like some type of Native American thing. No, it's just right. Tomahawk backwards. No. It's not that.
Yeah. Dave, how'd you get hooked into show skiing?
Same lake that you got hooked on, Lake Sherwood, Wisconsin, Rome, Wisconsin. And
you grew up there. You lived there.
I did, but I was actually from Wisconsin Rapids at that time, living just out down the road from the river site that the aqua skiers were on. But my aunt and my uncle just bought a place on Lake Sherwood and came down, and my cousins ended up going ahead and joining that team being the Shermelot Show Ski team, of course. Mm-hmm. And went to the first show, and I shit you not, my mouth hung open. I don't think I blinked, and I just took it all in. And mm-hmm. my parents still talk about it to this day. They're like, it was hook, line, sinker. I mean, I was mesmerized by the whole thing, and that's what I wanted to do. And like literally the next week, we were out behind my aunt and uncle's, you know, deck boat and trying to do deep water starts with, you know, two taper flex skis. And, you know, it went from there. And the next year that I was on the ski team ultimately. So, and started riding Barefoot Pyramids and got lucky because I had two guys like Bob Anderson and Dan Strobel who are still skiing mm-hmm. to this day, doing Barefoot
yeah.
Pyramids together.
Amazing.
I'm amazing. I mean, they're studs.
Amazing.
And, they share the same love for the sport and that team in general.
I wonder if they would carry you on a BFP again. Can we reenact
yes,
this?
Yes, let's do that.
Dan Strobel probably could. Bob Anderson would probably say, hell no, I'm not going to take it.
And you have to stand straight up, straight, locked
but
on knees.
You just think of, you know, and I won't take too much time, but like on that team at that time was the Strobels, who are well-known, Dave and Dan and whatnot. There was the Clarys, Jennifer Clary, arguably the best female barefoot water skier of all time, and her brother, and just a ton of talent, and to be around that was just, it was really, really cool, and the perfect setting as we grew up. Matt, similar, I mean, your first exposure, right?
Yeah, I mean, so my parents had a cabin on Lake Sherwood. My great-grandfather actually built it. You guys have all been there, gorgeous property. We no longer have it. It was awesome. I grew up skiing there. So, you know, learning on a little surfboard at 2-3 years old and just being a recreational skier, but watching every time we'd go up to the cabin, we'd watch the Shermelot show. We'd go and watch the show. And it was never a thing where I could join the team because we were only there a few weekends a summer. We shared it with other family and was never there that often, but got to know people. Nowicki's lived two doors down from where our cabin was, And so Mike Nowicki and family, we got to know there, then got to know Raisins. And like, Dave, you probably remember the picture of you, me, Mike, and Todd Whipperforth barefooting behind the Barefoot 200. We're all 12 to 14 years old, and it's four of us in a barefoot line on Lake Sherwood. You know, just young kids and friends at that time. That's how I got hooked, is watching that show. And then went back to Madison and said, we got to find a ski team here. And there was. And I had never really been to the shows in Madison. That was a weird thing. Like, we spent more summers up north and saw more Shermalot. I remember seeing Jennifer Clary. I remember times when there were, he wasn't skiing full time, but I remember a few shows where Kerry Tolsman came and guest skied mm-hmm. with Shermalot. Often like the Labor Day show, he'd yep. come in at the Sherwood Lodge and he would guest ski. But I remember those moments, and then got to know these guys, but joined the team in Madison in 88 when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. It was when I first got hooked, and then it's been that way ever since then.
Yeah, it's a crazy community, right? Like, I mean, now Schallers are up there as well. There's a lot of families that originate from that area who vacationed mm-hmm. in that area, who've gotten exposure to show skiing, and it's just a cool setting. So hats off to them.
So when you guys got hooked, what are, like, so I was thinking about this today, like, just reminiscing about the past. What are some of the first memories you have? Like, you mentioned watching that show and being jaw-dropped. Like, so those are early memories. I watched Shermalot. We went to Tommy Bartlett every summer. We would go to Noah's Ark, and then we'd go to dinner, and then we'd go to Tommy Bartlett. Like, that was a family trip once a summer. That was the thing we did. And you'd watch that show every year. But then once I was in show skiing, I got so, like, and nobody's shocked by this, I got so into it. I was so interested. And we would, like, literally record the ESPN Nationals onto a VHS tape from TV when it was on ESPN, hot summer nights. And we'd record it onto a VHS tape. And then I'd watch it over and over and over again. And I just became so interested in shows. Like, one of my first memories was the 88 or 89 Nationals, watching Badgerland show and seeing Paul Dross and the ballet line dancing to She's Got the Look. Like, this song is in my head and I picture it because I watched it on video so many times. And those early memories, those were locked with me as I first got into show skiing.
Yeah, I didn't move to the Madison area until I was like a junior in high school. So prior to that, I was over in the Waukesha area. So it was Badgerland that I would go watch. And I really, you know, I'd go watch the shows and it was awesome. And I also watched, you know, hot summer nights, but I really didn't have any idea about the competitive side of show skiing. Wasn't till I moved to Madison. I came and watched, I want to say it was a Madison ski team show. It wasn't Mad City yet. And, somehow learned that there was a competition in Wisconsin Rapids. And this was probably 95. And a buddy of mine from high school is like, hey, well, let's go up and let's go watch some shows. And I remember getting to Lake Wasatch and the beach was just absolutely packed. And I literally sat my butt on that beach all day and absolutely loved it. And we're like, this is so cool. We need to stay over. Well, try to find a hotel room on Saturday night in Wisconsin Rapids. We did. Literally, this place rented us like the janitor's closet. It had a cot in it and that was it. And they charged us like $100. Didn't care because we got up at 6 o'clock the next morning. We were on the beach, and you know, after that, it still took me a couple of years to join. I finally did. One of my first early memories of show skiing involves Matt Heilman.
Oh, geez.
So this was my first year on the team, and it was after the Labor Day show. We were having a little get together at Scotty's place in DeForest. You remember his duplex?
Oh yeah, I remember.
And there was some drinks involved. And Matt and I are outside on the side of the house watering the hostas. And Matt's like, Scheller, you have no idea how lucky you are to be skiing in 5X in your first year on the team. I remember that specifically. You were such an a-hole.
That is awesome. Yeah, I mean, you were in conventionals and pyramid and kneeboard and what else?
Barefoot line.
Oh, yeah. Barefoot line.
Yep. Yep. Hmm. That's, man, those were the days.
Well, do you remember?
Did you get skipped that year?
Yeah.
Right? 5X.
I got skipped over. Yeah.
No, but he worked himself into a conversation at the Dry Bean with Chris Copeland and I when we first presented to you the idea of becoming an announcer.
I didn't work myself into that conversation. You made me.
We cornered you. We invited you to a meeting at the Dry Bean, and this was like on the verge of our 2-year plan to grow the team and win nationals.
Yep.
And you had done some bit parts in the show, and you and Duck, and we didn't have any stable announcing, and we're like, Adam, we think you'd be an awesome announcer. We want to train you to be our next announcer.
Yeah. Yep. That's. And I remember that conversation.
How far out of your comfort zone did that make you?
You know, honestly, when the years prior, because I wasn't in a ton of acts, but I was in 5, I was in skits, and I actually really enjoyed it, and I think that kind of showed. And so it wasn't really – I wasn't like, oh, my God, this is going to be awful. I was like, yeah, I can do this. Let's do this.
Adam's been a lifelong introverted performer. I mean, he was a Norwegian dancer. He's done stage performances his whole life.
Yeah. So no, it really wasn't – I remember that conversation, and I was like, well, if we're going to do that, because you guys had kind of laid out that 2-year plan, like, hey, we're going to build up Mad City and we're going to win nationals in 2 years. And I'm like, yeah, I'm all in. I just, if I'm going to do this, I want to be really good at it. And it was nothing but VHS tapes for the next 9 months.
You and I met at my parents' house, and I slapped a bunch of tapes on the counter, and we started watching Brian Cullen.
Dross.
Dross, we watched,
all of them. Jim Lasky.
Yep. And we went through all those shows and pointed out what they did well, their technique, talked that through. And you and I, like, when was that? Was 98, 99, 2000, 2001?
It would have been 2000.
That you first became an announcer. So, like, 98.
The 2-year plan actually went
was,
3 years.
Not until 02, 03, 04.
Yeah, I think I want to say it was 02. Then it was 02. Okay.
But we're in our mid-20s, working, learning how to do that, and you studied and you got after it, and that was it.
That was a long time ago.
How come in nearly 25 years there has not been a Mad City skit in which Adam is Norwegian folk dancing? That is an untapped effing resource right there.
And we have other Norwegian dancers on the team.
We have a lot of Norwegian dancers on the team.
We have several. We could do a whole stage thing with Norwegian dancers.
I did the alumni show last year. I did the alumni show last year, and it's like, man, I never left, man.
Mm-hmm. Still got it.
Clogged with the best of them.
Yep. You mentioned State, and I got my brain going. Those early days of State. We've probably talked about it at some point in this podcast, but the people would go at 4 a.m. to dig chairs into. And this is before they had a lot of bleachers. Before, when the beer tent was 1/4 of its size,
or no beer tent.
Had a beer tent. There was no beer tent, right? And there
was a Wild West up there.
And people would like overnight dig in chairs and line the beach, and then bring coolers. They would bring kegs and dig holes in the sand. But it was BYO for a long time, and then people would sit in the sun all day, and it was a fucking shit show the whole beach. But people sat on that red sand beach and watched shows, and it was awesome.
What could go wrong, right?
Right.
Bringing a keg or a cooler of hard liquor, digging it in the sun
all day,
sitting in 90-degree humidity, and drinking all day long. I mean, to your point, like, I remember as we were kids back then, but I remember going ahead and watching people just completely passed out. And I mean, there overnight almost, and being drugged out and people puking and throwing. I mean, there was a considerable, I believe, conversation about how do we rein this in, and hence the advent of the beer tent.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
So, okay, I'm gonna ask you some more questions. This kind of gets away from our early days, but you guys have spent a lot of time as show directors, like with your home teams, Team USA. So what is it like as, I'm going to call you chronic show directors.
Sounds like a disease.
It probably is. As a chronic show director.
A metastatic show director.
What is it like on your team when you're not the show director? Like, are you constantly biting your tongue? Is it relaxing for you? Like, oh, I don't have to think and worry about this. Or is it, what is it like? Because you guys are very, I don't want to say controlling, but you have, you know, when you're show directors, you're in charge. And what is it like when you're not the show director?
It's changed over time for me. I've thought a lot about it. Like, so I've ebbed and flowed with it. Sometimes when I'm show director for multiple years in a row, I'm burned out. I'm completely, like, I back off completely.
Checked out.
Completely checked out. And I remember back in the day, a team member got mad at me and said I basically left the team high and dry. And I was like, no, I was just show director 3 years in a row. I need a break, and I need to let the current show director do their thing. So, like, it ebbs and flows with the experience of the show directors and how much they want and need. I've done a better job over time as I've aged, as I've matured, and one, mentoring other leaders within the club that are interested in doing it. And two, I probably do less than I should, not wanting to step on people's toes. Like, I want them to ask me for help. And often I'll feel like they're not asking me for enough help. And the reality is they're just fine without me. And that's what I've come to learn is, like, there are multiple really good leaders that can do this job at a really high level. And I don't need to do it all. So I try to not step on toes. So I try to let them lead. When the time is needed for help or assistance, or other people need help with drivers asking questions about patterns, or show producer asking questions on flow, or you, sometimes people default come to me. Like, you, Adam, will come to me and ask a question about timing or flow rather than asking the current show directors.
And that's just out of habit. Change. Let's just
no, because it's our working relationship we've had over time, and I can give you a quick answer to a lot of stuff, and so we've built that over time. But I try to let the leaders be leaders. Now, I was just talking to Katie about this last night. You know, as good as I know I am as a show director, there are things that I don't do as well as other people, and I'm recognizing that more and more and more. And I watch it in my own son. So I see Jack and Abby and Cody are our current show directors, and what they do way better than me. I'm going to give you a perfect example right now of their leadership. Is last fall, they had scheduled team practices up till October. I never did that as show director. They just want to ski more. Like, they bring more skiing passion and push as young, hungry show directors than I do. I might have more institutional knowledge of leadership and show directing. They're just hungry to ski. And it's super fun to see. They're pushing people. So Mad City's doing ATBs last September with scheduled team practices and swivel and jump. Our ski jump is going in the water Saturday.
Yeah, we just got 10 inches of snow.
Saturday, April 6th, Jack and Cody said, weather looks decent enough. We're going to put the jump together and anchor it. Who's in? And 10 people raised their hand and said, I'm coming to help. Our jump is going in the water this weekend because they all want to ski. And they bring that to the table, to the team, that I never did. That, like, I never fathomed putting the jump in the water before May 1st. It never even crossed my mind. And they're like, weather's good, let's put it in, let's go ski. And so that's super fun to see. And so they're it's a long-winded answer for I try not to step on their toes. They have gifts that I don't have. The flip side, it can be stressful because I do like, if I'm being totally honest, like I know and like to have a thumbprint on the show and what's going on. Because I feel like, at least from a production and flow and personnel standpoint, that I have some skills there and that I've done it for so long that I feel attached to it. And so in that way, that can be hard. But I've learned to let that go a little bit.
Dave?
Well, I think I share a lot of those feelings and those different thoughts. I think that when I'm not show director, the thing that's changed the most is probably myself over the course of the last number of years. You know, whether it be successes or, you know, regional championships or national championships or Team USA or whatnot, you know, what comes with that sometimes is maybe, to be honest with you, maybe an inflated ego on my part in terms of, mm-hmm. Hey, I know more than what others do that are on the team. And any good leader understands that, you know, there, unless you have the buy-in of others and unless you let others give them the opportunity to lead, you're not going to go anywhere. You're not going to improve. And it's taken me a number of years to realize that and to get comfortable with that. And so similar to Matt, I enjoy when the show directors or assistant show directors or production folks, they come to me and they ask. But I try not to interject. I try not to step on any toes. I try to stay in the background. But that's also really difficult on my team, on our team, because I have been kind of such a figure on the team that if I am in the background too much, people are like, oh, what is he thinking? What is he saying? Why isn't he saying something? He must be disagreeing with it. He doesn't like it. He doesn't agree with the show director. And that's not necessarily the case. Recently I've gone through a lot of leadership training over the last few years, just in my role within the organization I work for. And part of success is failure. And you have to allow people to stumble, to fall, to pick themselves back up in order for them to grow. And in order, if they grow, then the club grows. And by going ahead and stepping in on that, or wanting that control, or wanting that, that spotlight at that time, that doesn't do anybody any good. It just causes fracture ultimately. And so that's what I've learned and something that I try to check and balance. Now on the way home at night with the kids, right? That's a whole other situation where dad, mom, what's going on? Blah, 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 blah. And we can, but it's not until then that we have those conversations. So.
Yeah, it's tough. Like I haven't found because like you and I have been show directors so many times, I've done it 16 times for Mad City.
Who's counting?
That's a crap ton of time. I've not found that it's a fine line between I want to help and be there to support the show directors and not step on their toes. And the perception from the team, you just mentioned it, Dave, is that like if I'm helping, am I stepping in too much? Is Matt trying to take over? If I'm not helping, is the perception, why isn't he helping more? He knows so much about this sport and this show. Why isn't he helping these show directors more? And there's not a proper solution to that. At the end of the day, like I want to help as much as they want me to help.
Yep.
And I'll be there for them no matter what. I remember you, Dave, years ago. It's an RAJ thing, but your thing was, we're not going to let you fail.
Yep.
Whoever takes over show director, we're here to support you and you will not fail. And that's sort of where I'm at, but I still haven't found the right balance in terms of how much I do an offer versus letting them be free. And it's hard now this year. Like Jack and I last year were show directors together, father and son, super cool. Now he's on his own. I am not. And I probably told this story before, but it was super funny. It was this fall. Adam, maybe I haven't told this on the podcast. I told this to other people. Adam sent out the script, initial draft of the script in the fall. I was on that email. It was to the show directors, the stage crew, and me. And Jack and I then were at home and had a conversation. And I said, have you reviewed Adam's script? And he's like, yeah, we had some dialogue on it. I said, what are your next steps with the script? And he said, I think we're going to have a small group session to brainstorm ideas. And then we're going to take it to the larger team, a larger group to flesh out some ideas. And I said, sounds great. Great plan. He goes, I don't think we're going to have you part of the smaller group. We'll invite you when it's the larger group.
You probably didn't even respond. Probably dumbfounded.
I mean, what am I supposed to do? Like, so I'm like, all right, I guess the message has been sent. They don't need me, which is great. And so I'm walking this line of wanting him, and I've been show directed with Abby several times. Cody's a brand new show director and he'll be fine. They're doing it as a triad and he's a newer show director, but he's run our junior team a bunch of times. But Abby, they've got experience. Jack now has a season under his belt. They're going to be fine, but it's like, I got to let them spread their wings. And it was funny the way he delivered that. Like, no, we're good. We don't need you right now. Was the message I got. So then I'm trying to stay out of the way. And when or if they need help, I'm here to help.
You know, I don't think you should take offense to it. I think that they're looking at you as maybe the closer. They're doing like this, like, yep, bring them in. Let's go ahead and let's clean it up. And that, right. And wait till it's all done. And then they want that final touch. Take it like that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Sure. Right, exactly, exactly.
How long are you guys going to do this for? And I'm not talking about show directing specifically, but, I mean – are you guys going to eventually hang up the skis and jump in a boat? I mean, what? I feel like both of your families, your kids are going to be in it forever.
Dave's going to do it longer. He's younger. He's fit. He's going to stick it out. I'll let him answer. But I'm about there. I don't think my kids are ready for me to be there, but my mind and my body is ready to move on from off the water, like into something else. My challenge is I would love to drive boat. I think I'd be just fine and a skilled driver, but I can't show direct from a boat. So if I commit to being a boat driver, I am decommitting from show directing. Because I just can't operate. I can't lead a team from on the water. I got to be on land. And so that is a struggle for me. Like if I ever want to show direct, I can't commit to being a boat driver. And so then figuring out what my next phase is sort of on my mind now, what that looks like for me. You know, show directing with my kids, they want me to still ski with them and alongside them and be part of the show. But It's getting there for me.
Yeah, and I would say, despite what my sister has gone on record by stating, I am not 50 years old quite yet. That being said, 47, and the reason that I ski are my kids and are my family. I love being out there with them, just like Matt said. But it's also my jump guys, and it's also when I'm lucky enough to be a part of Team USA to be out there with those guys, and just having them push me to be better. And so I like that external push that drives me to work out every day, that drives me to, you know, Chandler, you laugh at me all the time, jump on my spin bike, jump on my elliptical, do my core stretching, strength. If I don't do that at my age, there's no way, there is no freaking way I could do what I wanted to do for that small 9 to 12 week period of time during the summer. So I like that the sport and my family and the guys all push me in regards to that.
We also have an over 50 award in the podcast that people are striving to win.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. So no, that I don't know, but I've always also said that I've set kind of a expectation for myself and the way that I ski and whatnot. And if I'm not able to live up to that expectation, I don't want to be one of those guys that hang on and people are like, come on, it's time to hang it up. And they feel bad about it. So at that point in time, I'm out.
Adam, you're out in a while, aren't you?
Yeah.
How long are you going to hang on?
The end of summer 2025. 2025 would be my last summer. You know, go ahead.
Go ahead. You're going to be an empty nester.
Well, you know, after 2012 Worlds, right, Team USA, being part of the first ever Team USA winning Worlds, I was like, I'm at the peak of my, call it career, if you want. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, yeah, I'm done. And then my daughter kind of got more involved. And so, you know, just like you guys, it just kind of sucked me back in, which I'm glad it did. I mean, I've had a blast, the last decade. It's been awesome. But, you know, my daughter will be, Annika's going to be a senior in 2025. And she, you know, unlike your kids, she is, you know, your kids are, I feel like both your families, your kids are just like show ski 24/7, 365. I see that when we were on spring break, they just want to ski all the freaking time, which is awesome. Annika's a little more seasonal. She's involved in music. Like that's her number one. And that's from September right to school's out. And then she's all in on ski team. And so, you know, we'll kind of see where it takes her. She's Adam's daughter, right? And you know, it'd be cool to see to go down to a ski show or a ski tournament and not be involved and yet still have her involved so I can just, you know, kind of sit there and watch and she can kind of do her own thing. I think that'd be pretty cool. But I love the sport. It's awesome. But there's a lot of other things I love to do too. And yeah. I love summer. And you guys know, you're committed to ski team, it is year round all summer. I mean, you're just around. You just can't really go places. And I love to paddleboard. I love to do a ton of stuff in the summer. And, you know, you'll find me after 2025 paddling different lake every single day. I mean, that's my goal.
See, that's the difference. But, you have something to do. We have nothing to do.
We have no life.
We
have nothing.
I was going to ask about a huge
void.
We have nothing. It's like, we have nothing.
Yeah, we have.
Well, you know, I can't, and you know, I can't say that, you know, specifically that, you know, that life is going to be awesome and great because I don't know what summer looks like without ski team. None of us.
He might Michael Jordan retire on us. He's done that before.
Yeah, and then go to a different team.
And then come back. No, God, fuck no. If you do that, I'll kill you. I'll kill you.
I was going to ask, I did write a note before the show, like, what do you guys do when you're not thinking about ski team? I mean, other than drinking bourbon, which I still don't understand, that is literally like drinking kerosene.
I've worked on you a little bit.
Oak over spring break. You didn't think that was bad.
Well, that was on ice. And I was already half in the bag, so that's different.
That's right. Okay. All right.
And in the bag for me, just so everybody understands, is like one drink. You know, I had a
two long drinks at night.
Yeah. I had two long drinks. But yeah, what do you guys do? What do you guys do for fun other than, you know, anything related to water skiing? Dave, you like to shoot things.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is where the whole pitiful conversation picks back up, right? I mean, it's work, and I work, you know, right now on average 10, 11 hours a day, and then it's, you know, thinking about Team USA and what we need to do. But you're right, I really enjoy hunting, and I enjoy, obviously, getting the dogs out. We do a lot of upland bird hunting. My son absolutely loves deer hunting and pheasant hunting and all that kind of stuff. It's also a great workout. And, you know, just keeping up with the kids. I mean, when you have three kids who are all 16 years and under, 9 years old, 16 years old, there's never any shortage of, you know, things to go to or whatnot. So I don't know, just like you guys, I mean, we're Uber drivers for our kids at this point in time.
We are. We're Uber. I was going to say that same word as Uber, which is great. Like I love watching my kids events. Like I love going to Eli's basketball games. 100%. I love doing that. I love watching them do their thing. Riley's dance recitals. I love it. But the other thing, I mean, for me, like I don't know. Like, Katie and I try to keep a healthy social life. Like, we try to schedule regular date nights and get out and go out with friends. And I'm kind of a planner, and I like...
You're always the one that leads the way, and, hey, guys, we need to get together. If it wasn't for you, we'd never see each other. Like, it wouldn't happen.
Great.
I mean, someone's got to do it, so I'll continue. But I like doing that. So I like connecting with friends. I like traveling. Like, Katie and I will plan, you know, we'll take a vacation with kids. We'll take a vacation for just us. Yeah. And some people don't do that, and we prioritize us maybe more than some, and we enjoy that, and so we're just trying to live our best life, and it'll be post skiing. I don't think there'll ever be a post skiing because our kids will be so involved. Yeah. Like, there was a moment at like 12 years old I wondered if Jack was really into it, and now I think laugh he was at that. No, yeah, he wasn't. No, and no, now he's now look in. Like, yeah, he's in more than I've ever been in. Like, he is in, he is loving life and living his best life, which is fantastic. And Riley's the same. She is hooked. She is hooked on the sport. So I don't think we're going anywhere for a while. Even if we have a next phase, our kids are going to do their thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting as, I've got my twins are graduating high school this year. Still kind of blows my mind, but our kids are our identity, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're our identity. And, you know, ski team, you know, for me, it's Adam, the announcer, right? And I'm going to be an empty nester, and I'm kind of hanging it up on the announcing side. And I do kind of think in the back of my mind, like, what am I going to do? Who am I going to be? Like,
it's so funny. You're Adam, and like you mentioned earlier that Annika is Adam's daughter. Like, we all have that in some capacity. I think that'll start to flip, right, as our kids become their own selves. Like, Jack Heilman is Jack Heilman. He's not Matt Heilman's son. He's starting to carve out his own name. And you want that. Like we're at the All-American, and I'm praying that the announcer isn't just going to ask them about being my child. Like, talk about them, and they did a good job of that, and which is good because I want the focus to be on my kids. And it was a funny story because this will flip for all of us. But I believe it was Riley, but it was at State. Like, we'll call it. Maybe it was just pre-COVID. Maybe it was just after. She saw Aragorn, who had been on Team USA. She's too young to really know Jerry. She knew Aragorn. And she said, she saw Jerry, not Aragorn. She saw Jerry and said, that's Aragorn's dad.
Oh, wow.
She called him Aragorn's dad instead of the reverse. Like, you know, we're talking about there are kids.
Yeah.
It wasn't Jerry Lighting's son. It was, that was Aragorn's dad.
Yeah.
And that was so funny. We talk about that all the time to this day. But that's going to flip for all of us at some point, too.
Yeah. We're going to age out.
Hopefully.
Yep.
We'd love for kids to be more successful than any of us.
Yep, 100%. Gentlemen, do we have other stuff to talk about? I mean, we can make this a two-part episode if you want. Unscripted, part one and two.
We really could, I think, but most people probably stop listening about 40 minutes.
Probably.
Yeah. I'm gonna end with things I would want to talk about.
I want to end, if we're going to wrap it up, because we're probably close to time here, but I want to end with what, I mean, it's 100 episodes, right? What influence do you think that, and I'm asking both Matt and Adam, what influence do you think that the podcast has had on the show ski community? What do you hope that the message has been? What do you hope that you've brought to people over the course of the last 100 episodes?
I'll start. You know, just from my own personal experience, you know, people love to joke about Adam the introvert, which I am, right? I'm not a great conversationalist in public. I'm working on it, though. We're working through it. It's been the opportunity to hear all these stories, people that I wouldn't normally probably talk to. You know, I know who they are. I don't know their stories, but I hope that's what we're bringing. Is there's so many personalities in show skiing. There's so many great people, all aspects of the sport, coming from all walks of life, and just kind of bringing that to light of, you know, this is such a great community. That's, I mean, that's to me what it is. And I will also say, I think a big part of it is also the, you know, the Ski Show Awards. I mean, what that's done for the community, just seeing that just absolutely from an idea in Matt's head that I thought was just absolutely insane that nobody was going to show up for. And I was literally going to have to write a check for all the expenses that we couldn't cover. I'm serious. I was like putting money aside because we had, you know, all of these costs associated with putting together the first award show. I was like, nobody's coming to this, dude. This is going to be a flop. That was my thought. And Matt pushed through, and it was, and now it's just like, holy smokes. We're to the point like, man,
now you guys are breaking in the
door. Chula's got to add on more square footage. We are running out of space. And it's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say, when we started it, like, a couple of goals were to shine a light on show skiing, right? Like we talked about at the beginning, we've got this passionate audience that is wants to consume information about our sport, wants to soak it up. We don't have a media outlet. Water Ski Magazine doesn't do a lot on show skiing. There just isn't a lot for show skiing, and we have this passionate, awesome sport. And so to bring that to the masses was one part. Two, and it happened after our first couple of episodes, somebody mentioned to us that we are making skiers feel like celebrities. And we're making them sound and become celebrities. And that is awesome. Like, to give people that feel, to shine this light on the sport and on people and on their stories and on their careers, that they're celebrities to us, and these stars and these future stars. And it's become a cool thing in that way. Secondarily, the ability for industry businesses to have a forum to broadcast their business to our niche audience has been super cool. Like, we don't have sponsors of our podcasts and of our award show to make money for Adam and I. It's really to provide a medium for them to grow their business. And that's the thing I've talked to every person who sponsored an episode or multiple episodes or sponsored for a whole season or a lifetime, like Flyman and Board Shop. They've been with us since the beginning. My conversation with them is, how can we help you grow your business? And so that's been a secondary piece of that. And I hope we've been able to provide them an audience for their business. And then, like Adam said, the award show has been more powerful, probably become more powerful than I envisioned, although I had big visions to begin with. Like, I'm a big thinker. I think big. And out of the gate, when I presented Adam with, like, we're going to do 30 awards and here's what it's going to look like, that was a big idea out of the gate. And to then deliver on that and to see where it is today is super special. So I do think that, so, like, did I ever envision that we're going to have any influence on the sport? No. I envisioned that we're going to provide some fun media, news, conversation that our audience will soak up, because we love show skiing. We all love talking about show skiing. We're a passionate sport. But I do believe that it's reached an audience that we have a committed audience that listens to every episode. And then the awards show has become, like, we talk about people wanting to make Team USA. Now people want to win awards. They're setting out goals to win some of these awards. They're getting nominated for Swiveler of the Year and Male and Female Athlete of the Year and D2 Skier of the Year and Team of the Year. Like, people have these goals. I was talking to a bunch of people from Lake City, and they said one of the reasons they traveled to Think Tank, they wouldn't always necessarily make that long of a drive, but it's the award show, and they were nominated for stuff, and they won a bunch of awards, and that is cool to hear. Like, that we've become that piece, which is fun.
That is cool. Here's a quick story that I love that I learned on Think Tank, or not Think Tank, on spring break, that I think is fun to share. So a number of families were over, and I think it was Shannon Wendricks who shared this story. You know you've hit it big time. You know that the podcast means a lot when Shannon or Paul were up one morning and they walked by Brooklyn's bathroom and she was taking a shower. Brooklyn Wendricks being their daughter, taking a shower in the morning, and Paul walks by the bathroom and all of a sudden, and Brooklyn's taking a shower, and all of a sudden he hears Matt Heilman's voice coming from the shower. Every father's fucking nightmare, right? And of course, Brooklyn's going to kill me. She's going to be so embarrassed. She's listening to none other than the podcast in the Wednesday morning. In the morning, on a Wednesday morning, as soon as it's released. So, it goes without saying, you know, you're reaching all ages. You're reaching, you know, all different types of skiers, skiers who are pro, skiers who are amateur, skiers who are starting out, young, old, whatever. And it's influencing and it's making a difference. So congratulations to all you guys, to each of you on 100 episodes. It's pretty phenomenal.
Well, congrats to you, Dave. I think you've been on the show the most.
Once you again,
got frequent flyer miles.
Once again, yep. Pitiful and pathetic.
Yeah. Who should we have on the show? Well, who's available? Well, Dave's available.
Dave, yeah. We'll get Dave.
Yeah.
By default, we got Dave. Oh, it's been awesome. 100 episodes in the books. You know, like, we didn't do any sponsor ads this time, but obviously thank you to Flyman Skis. Thank you to the Board Shop. That's been, they've been amazing partners for years. Lake Lovers Club, these ongoing sponsors with us. Can't thank enough. Adam, thanks to you for 100. I don't know if we got 100 more in us, but we'll keep her going for a while.
Yep, Matt, thanks for you. Thanks to you for starting this journey. It's been absolutely awesome. And of course, thanks again to all of our listeners sticking with us for 100 episodes. This is Matt and Adam, and this is The Ski Show.
Thank you for listening to The Ski Show, the ultimate show ski podcast with Matt and Adam. If you have questions or ideas for the show, find us on social media or message us at theskishowpodcast@gmail.com.